Yours, mine, and ours. My name is Gabrielle Cardona. I'm a relationship coach and an MBTI practitioner. As a coach, I've worked with individuals and couples. In my show, I discuss important life questions with my listeners. What are relationships made of? What makes a relationship successful? Relationships are a dynamic between two separate individuals that consists of a physical, mental and emotional connection between them. But there are actually three different elements to a relationship connection: the two people separately, and the third element that's the entity of what they create together, separate and distinct from each of them as people. This show is about how to personally become a better individual, separate from any other person, as well as facilitating the improvement of others, individually and separate from you, so that whenever you do come together with another person, you're both better and have a positive impact on each other as a combined entity. Welcome to the show. Now, a little bit about myself and how I ended up here. When I was a young girl, my mother knew there was something wrong with me. She just knew. So she sent me to counselors, therapists, and psychiatrists for years and years, and they tried to make me take pills, but they never worked. Inevitably, they would eventually all send me back to my mother, basically saying, "Yeah, no, she's not really fixable." But that didn't stop my mother from trying. "Well, you know what? Maybe you need to go on a special diet." So I would read about different mental illnesses. Yes, the very young age of 8, and I heard it on television, on talk shows, and experts on news shows. So, just for fun, I would feign different symptoms, you know, to make the sessions more interesting. But it always had the same outcome. No, I was just defective. It always frustrated me, and it hurt my self-esteem to know that I wasn't what my mother wanted. And I didn't think I was crazy, but I was given a lot of different labels by the psychology industry. Everything changed for me one day. I was in third grade. My teacher told us that we're going to take a personality test. That sounded suspiciously like a shrink on the down low attempt to figure out what was wrong with me. I was paranoid, and I certainly wouldn't put it past my mother to get the teacher to figure out what was wrong with me. So, when I read the questions, none of them really had anything to do with a mental illness. So you know what? Just for kicks, I decided to answer honestly. Well, when I got the results, I was amazed at how the words on the page described me perfectly. It was saying things that had nothing to do with the original questions. They were random general questions. But it explained why I do what I do, and how I feel and how I think when I do those things. No one could ever figure that out. Well, I later found out that it was the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator Personality Profile System. Now, that's actually pretty popular around the world, and it's a generally accepted tool because it is pretty accurate. But according to this explanation of my personality, everything about me was normal for my personality. The only tough part to accept, I'm only about 2% of the human population. So I'm often misunderstood and misjudged. Sometimes I'm mistreated simply because my words and actions are misunderstood by most people. And some people are very irritated by my general approach to life. They're overwhelmed by my unconventional way of thinking. But I could handle that even at a young age because I don't generally need the approval of other people in order to be happy. First of all, as an introvert, relationships for me are few and far between. All I would need to do is know what people want so I could give that to them while we're together. Then I wouldn't have to feel bad about being myself when they're gone because I have a lot of great qualities that make the world a better place. And when I did form relationships, they were powerful and profound, so a few would truly fulfill my soul. And I didn't need to change my personality, I didn't need therapy, and I absolutely didn't need pills. Today we're going to be discussing mindfulness about our true nature in the context of personality. Now, mindfulness is a popular word and it's thrown around a lot in the self-help industry, the mental health industry. But what is mindfulness? Well, that kind of depends on who you ask. But the most universally accepted definition is a mental state achieved by focusing one's awareness on the present moment while calmly acknowledging and accepting feelings, thoughts, and bodily sensations. Okay, so what does that mean? It means you know how you're feeling, you know what's going on inside of you, and you know what's going on around you. Okay, so we're going to open up the lines kind of early in the show because our listeners may have different questions and comments as we go through the different levels of function for different MBTI personality profiles. Feel free to call the station and tell Doug, my producer, your name, where you're calling from, and what you'd like to ask. The number to the station here is 888-627-6008. We're going to take a real quick commercial break. Repeat that number when we come back. This is yours, mine, and ours.
BBS Radio.com.
Welcome back to yours, mine, and ours. I'm Gabrielle Cardona, your host. The number to the station here is 888-627-6008. And today we're talking about being true to your nature, being mindful of the true nature of your personality. Now, we can agree that we all need relationships, but being aware of who you are, separate from anyone else, is the first step to becoming relationship material. The key is knowing how to focus in order to be mindful of yourself in this way. And this can be tough because the world is full of distractions. Technology has made it almost impossible just for us to hold one thought. So let's go over how to be mindful of yourself, focused on who you truly are and accepting your thoughts, feelings, and bodily sensations as you go through your daily life. Now, I teach people, as I'm helping them understand their nature and their personality, three basic but potentially confusing things. First of all, what you do is your behavior. Why you do it is your character, but how you do it is your personality. Now, let me go ahead and say that again. What you do is just your behavior. Why you do it is an indication of your character, but how you do things is your personality. Okay, so now it's time to look kind of closely at yourself. Are you ready? First of all, the MBTI personality profile test has some issues sometimes that people have. So before we get into the specifics, ask yourself if this has ever applied to you. They take it more than once and they get different outcomes. Yeah, maybe their personality changed. Well, I used to be a, but now I'm a, okay. Or they may have taken an electronic version where they're simply asked to choose between two words. Well, I'm kind of both. How about they're not honest in their answers or they're judgmental about the results? Maybe because they have a preconceived idea or a certain feeling about certain things that they're really not happy about. Or maybe their behavior has changed over time, so they just assume that their entire personality has actually changed. And then there are people who just use it to justify a closed-minded approach to dealing with people because they don't want to do the work to actually create a relationship. Okay, those things only happen when an explanation of what this is, what it's for, and what it's about is not given to them first. And most people who administer this test are not qualified to administer it because it's not just about answering the questions and handling, you know, the results, handing them a piece of paper and saying, this is it, this is what it's about. When I charge someone a pretty high price to give them their MBTI personality profile, it's because I know how to see past the things that frequently hide someone's true nature. Most people, when they take a personality profile test, answer in the context of what they currently do. That's a mistake. When they answer what they're trying to do in an attempt to become a better person, well, this is what I'm doing now. This may include doing things that are actually contrary to the true nature of their personality. That's an even bigger mistake because it means that the person has some kind of negative feelings about who they truly are as a person. They don't like themselves. Could this potentially describe you? That's going to distort the judgment and inhibit the honesty of the person who's actually trying to learn more about themselves. The only way to be mindful is to become honest with yourself. Now, this can happen because people have had life experiences that were high impact, some in a positive way, some in a negative way. That modified their behavior. Now, keep in mind that it didn't change their nature, their personality, because again, nature is what it is. Nurture does not change nature. It just modifies how nature is displayed. So let's consider a few of the most powerful behavior punishments that would inhibit a person's willingness to be true to their nature. These experiences can actually stop them from doing things that are natural and easy and enjoyable for them. Some behavior punishments that I talk about with my clients, negative experiences, they're even more powerful in our life than our positive ones because the people and situations in our life can cause pain and suffering that's powerful enough to make us stop doing things that are natural and healthy, sometimes completely. Not only stop us from doing something constructive and positive, but even worse, they might even make us start doing something destructive as a second effect. As you think about the list of punishments that I'm going to describe here, some of them may be more difficult for you to think about than others. Some of these techniques may have been used on you in your life, creating pain for you. So it's very important for you to answer some questions about these things before you hear the list. Keep these things in mind as you listen to the different behavior punishments that I'm going to describe. Four questions. Number one, which one of these methods have been used most in my life? Number two, how am I affected now and in the past by these tactics when they are used? Number three, how many people in my daily life use these techniques instead of healthy communication and proactive resolution of conflict in order to inhibit me from being true to my nature? And number four, what can I say and do to set clear boundaries in my life, showing these people that they need to stop doing these things now? Okay, so think about these behavior punishments that you may have personally experienced. Public shame. That's using others' criticism and judgment to take away your self-esteem. Private humiliation. These include words and actions in secret that make you feel bad about yourself that no one else knows about. Personal rejection, like words or actions to convey disappointment or disapproval, not only of what you've done, but of who and what you are. Then there's emotional abandonment, being physically present around someone, but withdrawing on an emotional level to create a sense of loss or emptiness that has no physical manifestation. What about guilt? Simply manipulation of the conscience to get to someone on a profound level. Sometimes people use mental torture, activities that have no external marks but create confusion and disorientation inside of another person. Well, then we have just plain old physical pain, inflicting harm that leaves physical marks that can remain long after the initial action has stopped. Inflicting fear, by using threats of pain or torture, creating the emotional uncertainty and turmoil with the idea of just the possibility of horrible things happening, but them never actually happening. Deprivation, which is taking away physical necessities needed in order to survive, like food, heat, light. Or physical isolation, which is social deprivation that we need as humans, but depriving that person for an extended period of time. withholding love or approval, which is the denial of the basic and essential affection, love, emotional connection when we need it. This is a big one where my husband comes from, divine judgment threats, using the vengeance and punishment of God as a potential consequence to instill a genuine fear. And then some people use competition or rivalry by provoking jealousy and envy between different people who would otherwise love and accept and support each other to motivate someone to do something that you want them to do. Okay, these are some pretty big things. What things on this list have you personally experienced? Have you maybe inhibited certain parts of yourself in response to these things happening to you just so that they would stop happening? Okay, keep that in mind. Now, sometimes we're motivated to action through positive reinforcement. We are actually encouraged to do other things that may not be our nature by being rewarded through these behavior rewards. People have to do something they don't want to do sometimes, and the world and the people around them may motivate them by giving them something in return. And it's effective. But before we go over the list, ask yourself these four questions to see what your personal life experience has consisted of that will help you think about how much of what you currently do in your life is, by nature, what you truly want to do, and how much of it is simply because you know you'll be rewarded in some way for doing it. So it's worth the effort. Four questions are: which one of these items are the most rewarding to you personally, for you, by nature? Which ones would be the most motivational to convince you to do things that don't come naturally to you? Third, do the people in your life know this? And finally, would you be willing to tell them, to make them part of a process, if they want it to be, to reward you for something good? Okay, some behavior rewards include the fulfillment that comes from performing your dominant function. We'll go into that function pretty soon. It's an inherent feeling of satisfaction, a natural reward that you feel in your soul. Another popular one is verbal affirmation, the social influence in your life expressing words of approval and gratitude to you for what you have said or done or been. Then there's just social confirmation, which is the people around you doing and saying and being those same things. So it reinforces your desire to continue doing it. Now, we all know monetary compensation is motivational. Enough money to make the time and effort truly worth it, quote unquote. Then we have things like trade, which is just quid pro quo. I'll do it for you if you do this for me. Okay, how about karma? Knowing that what goes around comes around eventually, as a principle, not a religious doctrine, but knowing that if you do something good, some kind of reward will appear. Or there's self-reinforcement, internal dialogue that someone has to convince themselves of the virtue and value, to convince themselves to do it. The moral satisfaction is a very good one because it's a higher sense of responsibility to a larger or more powerful authority or purpose. Okay, then we have things like reciprocity, which isn't quite the same thing as quid pro quo. It's the expectation of a tangible return in direct proportion to the investment. That's actually quantifiable. Or how about a personal gift? Something genuinely pleasing as an acknowledgement and recognition. We've got titles, public official acknowledgement and recognition that others respect or that they're impressed by. Power, which is influence and control over what happens to other people. Or freedom, the opportunity to go and be and do what you want, being left alone. And, of course, we all love the confidence. That's a very rewarding feeling, knowing that you're right and the security that comes from that knowledge. But I saved it for last. Love and attention and affection. That's just the personal interest of the people who are most important to us. Okay, so We're going to think now about the things in your life that have been very rewarding to you to motivate you to do things that aren't necessarily, your nature. And then what things in your life have been done? What do I like? What do I not like? How much of what I'm doing right now is really me? How much of it is a version of me? We're going to go ahead and take another break. When we come back, we're going to take a very close look at the MBTI personality profile system, including how people think and feel as they're doing things that their personality wants to do, not just what they do. I'm Gabrielle Cardona. This is yours, mine, and ours. Welcome back to Yours, Mine, and Ours. I'm your host, Gabrielle Cardona, and today we're talking about taking a look at your true nature. Starting with your personality profile, the MBTI system is widely accepted and genuinely appreciated, but it's not always accurately understood. So today we're going to take a closer look at this actual personality profile system, not just at the dichotomies, but at the functional order of different personality types. Now, it's not always an easy concept to grasp, so I'm going to take it very slowly. And fortunately, the show is archived, so if you need to listen to it again and maybe stop, pause it, and think about it, and then go on to the next step, that's absolutely fine. But again, if as I'm going through this, you want to call in and ask a question, the number here is 888-627-6008. Okay, so let's just start with the four dichotomies. There are four letters to your personality, the nature of your personality. The first choice of personality preferences is your social energy. You're either an introvert or an extrovert. Where do you get your energy from? Do you like to spend time in the outer world of people and social interaction, which means you're most likely an extrovert, or in your inner world of private ideas and personal feelings? That leans more toward introversion. Introverts need to recharge when they've been around large groups of people or they've been socially active, interactive for an extended period of time. Introverts relax when they have time to themselves. They need to re-energize. They really do feel more at peace when they're alone. Extroverts become anxious and bored when they've been alone for a long period of time, and they actually relax when they're around other people with whom they can freely interact. Well, I love it when people say, I'm both. No, you're not both. You do both, because as we're going to find out, everybody has certain activities that they do in an extroverted way, and even extroverts have activities that they only do in an introverted way. So, just like introverts primarily lean towards introverted activities, there are still some things about their personality that they need to do in an extroverted way. So, let's see, a list of words. Extroverts are social, where introverts are more territorial. Extroverts are about interaction. Introverts really like to concentrate. Extroverts have multiple relationships. Introverts tend to have limited relationships. Well, extroverts tend to be gregarious, whereas introverts are more reflective. Okay, you know what? We can sit here and say words all day. These are the bottom line questions that I ask people. These are some of my favorites. First of all, how many people in your life would you say you're comfortable calling your friend? You know what? An extrovert, if they like you, if you get along and they remember your name, you're friends. An introvert, you know what? They'll probably be able to count on one hand the number of people in their life that are intimately special, important to them enough to be called a friend. We can like all kinds of people. Yes, I'm an introvert. I have a lot of people that I really enjoy being with. Only a select few of them are my friend. Another one is when you are talking, to someone, how much does it bother you to be interrupted? Well, you know what? An extrovert probably wouldn't even notice that they were being interrupted because they would just keep on talking and talking and talking. And when other people, you know what, are talking, they might actually interrupt them and not realize that they were interrupted. They'll go ahead and keep talking. An introvert will wait until you're done. Very quietly, wait until you're done. Are you finished? Because you know what? If you're going to keep interrupting me, I can go ahead and excuse myself from the conversation altogether. Which brings me to my next question. If you have a conversation going on and someone turns on an electronic device, right? Some kind of noise, something making loud noise, and it's going on in the background and you need to actually raise your voice just in order to maintain that. Well, you know what? An extrovert would be fine doing that. In fact, they might want to turn up the music as they're having a conversation. An introvert would not. They really don't want to have to build up that energy and spend that energy in order to be heard. Because really the people that they talk to are important to them. It's about quality. And that's why the last question that I ask, if you're having something special, something important going on in your life, would you want a large group of people? An extrovert would say the more, the merrier. An introvert would say, well, if it's truly special, then only special people get to be a part of it. Okay, most people know now, just by asking those basic questions, if they lean more towards, naturally, being an extrovert or an introvert. Now, the second letter of your personality is actually a little bit more difficult because, well, you have to really think about it. This is about your focus. Now, a lot of us aren't very focused or conscientiously aware of where our attention is. But the second letter is about where you prefer to focus as your senses are collecting information about your environment and your mind is simultaneously processing that information being collected by those senses. You're either sensory or intuitive. Now, just to let you know, the letter I is delegated to introvert. You're either E or I. So MBTI uses the second letter of the word intuitive, the N, to refer to that function. So the first one is E or I. The second one is S or N. Sensors pay attention to their environment and they're extremely aware of the many things perpetually going on all around them. They trust their own personal experiences and they direct their attention towards individual details and solid data. They accept concrete facts and take things at face value. But intuitives pay attention to the deeper level of what things mean, and they focus on what their minds and bodies are creating in the way of complete thoughts and ideas with the information that their senses have collected. They look at how all of the things in the world related to each other connect to each other, and the interconnectedness of everything around them as well as inside of them. So I kind of use it as an example of Legos. Sensors have the ability to literally, with their eyes and their ears and their hands, their mouth and their nose, experience everything going on, collecting individual pieces like little Legos that they have in front of them. And they know how to take all of these different pieces and put these things to good, practical, tangible use. And whereas an intuitive would say, let me put all of those pieces together. See how they connect to each other. See how they relate to each other. Oh yeah, I need to go do something in my external world. And I wonder what that means. And they create big picture concepts and ideas. This means that they're very internally focused. They know what they're thinking and what they're feeling about their experiences. Let me ask you some questions. If you're not really sure, just based on that general description, some things that I ask people or tell people, right, about sensors. They would have a meal in front of them that they've never had before, and they suspect it's probably not going to be very good because it smells kind of funky. Oh, yes, by the way, they smell everything. A sensor would take a bite of a meal that they suspect is probably pretty bad just to have the experience. They do things in life to stimulate their senses. An intuitive would say, you know, I appreciate the offer, but I'm good just sticking with what I know and what I like. Sensors take things in a very literal way. When you say to them, "So, where are you now?" Their answer is, "Well, I'm standing here in front of you in the living room. I don't understand the question." Intuitive would say, "Actually, I think I'm in a really important spot in my life, and I'm glad you asked. Let's talk about it." You know what? When you're talking to a sensor and you say, "Well, what do you think you're going to be doing next week at this time?" All they hear you say is, "Well, how in the world am I supposed to know what's going to happen 7 days from now? There's absolutely no way to know that kind of thing until you experience it firsthand." An intuitive would say, "Well, I know that because I've got this going on and this because I'm planning this, and that's pretty much what I'm going to say. Yeah, I can tell you pretty much what I'm going to be doing down the street, down the day, down the week, whatever, because I am constantly thinking about the future and the past." And a sensor would say, "Until you've actually jumped off a cliff, you don't know what gravity is about." An intuitive could say, "Well, actually, I've read about it for 4 years, so yeah, I'm good. I know exactly what it's about." Which do you think describes you better? Okay, so the third dichotomy is about how you make decisions. When you're making a choice, do you put more weight on objective principles and impersonal facts, which means you're a thinker? Or do you make the people involved and their personal happiness your primary focus? That means you're a feeler. T or F. Okay, now, when you make decisions, it would be great to know that it would always make people happy to make sense, and people would always be gratified by being rational and logical. But you know what? That's not going to happen. Thinkers accept that sometimes people just aren't going to be happy with their situation or experience or decision. And you know what? Thinkers are fine with that because if it makes sense to do something, in the long run, it will make people happier. Your displeasure right now, you know what? That's okay. I'm okay with that. Thinkers make rational thought the foundation for the things that they decide to do. And they consider personal feelings along the way. The same way they would consider other factors or details. They do not lend any more weight to feelings, even their own feelings, than they would to any other facts or details relevant to that situation. But feelers believe that people's happiness is the most important thing in life. It's the primary reason for the things that they say and do. If it makes someone happy to do something, it makes complete sense for them to do it. Facts are subjective and they're open to interpretation. While information is important, it's not the basis for what they're going to end up doing. When they're faced with a choice of their own happiness or someone else's, they will always make personal sacrifices without a second thought, even if it might not, on paper, seem to be in the best interest of the person that they've made that sacrifice for. Both preferences are about making people happy. They simply perceive happiness and they define it in different ways. And they believe that creating happiness requires a different approach. Now, there are obviously virtues and advantages to both. Some of the statements that a thinker would make. I like to debate and defend my point of view. Sometimes, just to expand my intellectual horizons, I'll argue both sides of an issue without personal conviction for either one of them, per se. Or I've been accused of not paying enough attention to other people's needs and feelings, but I don't know how they could say that. How about, I don't generally like to put my own emotions on display for others to see. It doesn't really serve any real purpose to me. Or here's another one. I don't shy away from critiquing or correcting people, even if it's only in my own mind, because I'm very aware of when a mistake is made. Some statements a feeler would make are, I feel that love cannot be defined, and I take personal offense at those who try to do that. Or, I will overextend myself to meet other people's needs. I'll do almost anything to accommodate others, even at the expense of my own comfort or health. I put myself in other people's shoes. I'm likely to be the one asking, how will this affect the people that are involved. And this one is definitely for feelers. People tend to seek me out for warmth and nurturing. Here's one final question statement. A thinker would say, I think that people's behavior should be based on laws. A feeler would say, I think laws should be based on people's behavior. Okay, that was pretty good, right? That was a pretty good, well, you know what, if you're still not sure, because you do both, okay, but again, what you do is just your behavior, it's not your personality. Consider this scenario. Imagine you were responsible to perform life-saving surgery on your best friend or a beloved relative. You had no idea what you were doing, but you were told that if you have the instruction manual and all of the tools and all of the time that you need in order to perform the procedure to save this person's life, but there was no anesthesia of any kind, and you'd have to listen to them suffering, the outcry of their suffering the whole time that you were saving their life. Ask yourself, how distracted would you be from doing your job by the other person's pain? A thinker would immediately emotionally detach from the situation in order to stay objective and focused while they work. Constant suffering of a loved one would torture a feeler the entire time that they were working, and they would be very, very much in pain as they were creating pain for the person they love. How much would you suffer if you knew that someone you loved was suffering, even while doing something good for that person, contributing to their pain, caused you pain? Okay, so the fourth letter, oh, okay, here we go. So the first one is E or I. The second one is S or N, sensory or intuitive. The third one is T for thinker or F for feeler. Now, the fourth dichotomy is about how you carry out the decisions that you've made. How do you prefer to set up and move through your life? Are you more comfortable in a consistent and structured environment, which means you're a judger? Or are you more likely to be adaptable and flexible, adjusting to what goes on around you, a perceiver? Judgers enjoy set standards and established boundaries. Consistency and stability provide a sense of security for them that allows them to flourish without concern for what could go wrong. When they know what to do, as well as when and how to do it, they enjoy spending their time and energy personally adhering to and maintaining those set standards and boundaries for the security and comfort of others. Perceivers prefer to have the freedom to choose to do what they want, and they use established rules and expectations as guidelines rather than mandates. Trusting their perceptions, they understand and accept that for every rule, there is at least one exception. Their willingness to respond to their surroundings and modify what they're doing in the moment to keep things going means that they're, generally speaking, laid-back people. They don't like to control people, and they immediately feel an urge to resist when people try to control them. Okay, so this is one of the easier ones to pretty much identify yourself as. But just in case you're not really sure, some of the good things that I like to tell people about judgers, they love to make lists. They like to do lists. They feel excited when they can check things off. Something that they've completed, they get a great sense. In fact, if they've done something that wasn't on the list, they'll put it on the list just to scratch it off, because they do feel good when they accomplish something. Judgers actually feel more excited at the end of a project. They are very, very passionate about keeping the schedule and staying on time, following through on responsibilities. If they have an appointment at 3:30, they would rather show up at 2:45 than 3:31. Seriously, it's better to be 45 minutes early than 1 minute late. Whereas a perceiver would say, you know what? I know I had that list somewhere. Where did I put that list? That to-do list. Maybe about 3 hours into the day. If, you know what? If they had an appointment, if there was a meeting, if there was something at 3 o'clock, and you know what? If they showed up at 3:05 and it still hasn't started, well, you know what? Then I'm not really late, am I? They'll start a lot of different projects, and you know what? They get their excitement more at the beginning. Perceivers are about the beginning, and as the project progresses, you know, the momentum, the enthusiasm can kind of fade away, so they might not always finish what they start. What are you more naturally? Okay, so E or I for your social energy, S or N for your primary function in life, T or F for the decisions that you make, and P or J in the way that you carry out your decisions. Okay, that could give you 16 different personalities. That's a lot of personalities. I don't want to know them all. Do you want to know them all? No. Okay. So let's just think about yours. This is the thing that people don't have explained to them past the, well, this is your profile. Sometimes they get their disposition, which is nice. That's a nice little general overview of their personality. What I'm going to explain today is called functional order. Okay. Functional order is just basically telling you that everybody does everything. You in life are even going to do things that are not your personality. Life demands that you do feeler things, even if you're a thinker. You're going to have to be sensory, even if you're an intuitive, because in life, you need to know what's going on around you, and you need to go and do and be the things that you're thinking about as an intuitive, right? Well, sometimes you need to actually do them. Okay. But even if you become very, very good at doing things that are not your personality by nature, you still have certain functional order of your activities. So, how to determine your functional order? The first and last letter of a personality indicate the preferred order and social orientation of the two middle letters. What that means is the two middle letters of either S or N and T or F are going to be displayed in an introverted and an extroverted way, and you are going to do things that are not your personality in an introverted and extroverted way. Okay, so let's take a look at the social orientation of the two middle letters. Okay, if you're an ISTP, you're obviously going to enjoy the S, right, more than N, and T more than F. But remember the fundamental principle that nature is always balanced. So if you're an ISTP, know that the social orientation of one of the letters, the other one will be the opposite. As an ISTP, if your T is introverted, your S will be extroverted. Okay, even if you're an introvert, one of them will have an extroverted orientation. So the first step is determining which one is introverted and which one is extroverted. Okay, so then once you know that, then you'll know, since you're an introvert, that your introverted function is going to be your dominant function. It's going to be more comfortable for you to do than your extrovertedly oriented function. But the last letter of your personality, the P or the J, is going to be what determines which one of the two middle letters is extroverted. It's not going to tell you which one is dominant or auxiliary. It's going to tell you which one has an extroverted orientation. And it's the first letter of whether you're introverted or extroverted, which is going to determine what order you do those activities in. And that's because carrying out the decisions that you make is a socially interactive activity. When you're carrying out the decisions that you've made, either as a P or a J, you have to be socially interactive. So the P perceiver is about the second letter because your second function, which is your focus, is a perceptive activity. If you're a J, the judging activity is the third letter of your personality. Making decisions is a judging activity. If you are a perceiver, the second letter of your personality will have an extroverted orientation. If you are a judger, the third letter of your personality will have an extroverted orientation. Okay, so let's go back to the ISTP. ISTP is a perceiving function of sensing, right? Will be extrovertedly oriented. That means the other letter, the T, will be introverted. But Since an ISTP is an introvert, it's their introverted thinking that will be their dominant function. The extroverted sensing is going to be auxiliary. Okay, now let's go ahead and take another example. Okay, an ESTP. Well, the P in this person's personality means that the perceptive function of sensing is going to be displayed in an extroverted way, but since an ESTP is an extroverted personality, the extroverted sensing will also be the preferred one, the dominant function. That would leave the thinking function with an introverted orientation and on an auxiliary level. How about an ESFJ? Well, the J would make the judging function of feeling extroverted. And since they're an extrovert, that means it's also their number one chosen function, their dominant function. So the other letter, the S, the sensing function, is introverted and it's number two on their list. Now, keep in mind the natural principles of balance as you think about the next part, because this is also true about degrees. Just like one of your functions is introverted and one of them is extroverted, well, when you're talking about a dichotomy, whichever one you prefer is going to be extroverted or introverted. The other one is going to have the opposite orientation when you're doing it. The third letter of your personality, one of them was introverted or extroverted. When you're doing the other letter of that dichotomy, which is not your personality to do that activity, it's going to have the opposite social orientation. Okay, so dominant, auxiliary. Dominant is number one, auxiliary is number two. The third one is tertiary. The third level is tertiary. And then the fourth level is inferior. So when you have to do activities that are not of your personality, you really need to keep in mind that some of them are going to be easy. Some of them are going to be, a little bit of a challenge. Some of them are going to be pretty hard, and some of them are going to be like running uphill barefoot in the snow. Thinking about the examples that we used, let's go with the ESTP. Okay, so now, if extroverted sensing is the dominant function and introverted thinking is auxiliary, then extroverted feeling is tertiary and introverted intuition is inferior. The dominant is really, really, really good extroverted sensing. They do it. They love it. It's great. That means to the same degree, they're bad at the opposite letter with the opposite orientation. The intuition is the opposite of sensing. And if their sensing is extroverted, when they're doing their intuition, it's going to be introverted. It's going to be really tough. Well, their introverted thinking is auxiliary. It's pretty easy for them to do. The extroverted feeling, which is the polar opposite of introverted thinking, it's not too hard. It's not really, really hard like introverted intuition, but it's still not natural for them. Okay, well, how about an ESFJ? An extroverted feeling is dominant. Introverted sensing is auxiliary. That means extroverted intuition is tertiary and introverted thinking is inferior. Okay, so if you need to go ahead and write that down, write those things down, because listening to it, it's not the same as looking at it on a piece of paper. Another example, the INTJ, let's just go ahead and sample this in our minds here. INTJ. We know that the J means that the judging function of making decisions is going to have an extroverted orientation. The third letter of T is going to be extroverted. That means the other letter, the N, is going to be introverted. Okay, so since they're an introvert, their introverted activity of intuition is going to be dominant. Their extroverted activity of thinking is going to be auxiliary. And the opposite of extroverted thinking, which is auxiliary, is introverted feeling. That's tertiary. The polar opposite of introverted intuition, which is their dominant function, is extroverted sensing. That's their inferior function. Okay. Well, you know what? That's a lot of information. The dominant function is so natural for someone. It's like breathing. They need to do that for 60% of their day. They literally, if they're awake 16 hours a day, they need to do their dominant function for 9 hours a day. Okay, their auxiliary function, you know what? It's like eating. I don't need to do it all day, every day to keep going. And it's not really hard. It's not, you know what? You only actually need to do it about 20% of your day. That adds up to about 3 and a half maybe hours. Your tertiary function, you need to do it, but it's like walking. Don't do it all day, every day, but you need to do it in order to stay healthy. Between 10 and 15% of your day should be doing your tertiary function, performing your tertiary function. You know what? That's about 1 to 2 hours a day. Your inferior function, it's like running. You really shouldn't do it more than 5% of your day, but you need to do it in a healthy way. 5%, maybe 10% at the most, means you really shouldn't spend more than an hour a day doing your inferior function. Ask yourself, think about this. How much of what you're doing right now in your daily life is your dominant function? How much of it is your auxiliary function? How much of it is tertiary? How much of it is inferior? Get your life back into the proportion of 60% dominant, 20% auxiliary, 15% tertiary, and 5% inferior. Yes, you have to do things that are not your personality, but do them in a healthy proportion and in a healthy way. So that way you know that you are going to be a happy and fulfilled person. If you need to think about your life's punishments and your rewards, things that might have stopped you from doing your dominant function or have forced you to do your inferior or tertiary function more than the proportions that I just described, how much of that is actually costing you your happiness? Get to know your nature. That will help you know who you truly are. Reach your full potential. Be more mindful. That makes you proactive. Yours, mine, and ours. Thank you for listening. I'm Gabrielle Cardona.